This is a podcast from RTE Radio 1.
Hello and welcome to Audioscope. The recent tragedy of the Dunn family in Mona Gear in County Wexford shocked the whole country. A father, mother and two young daughters losing their life in such a horrific manner. Adrian Dunn, the father of the two children and husband of Kira, had an eye condition which was genetic. Many questions have been asked and left unanswered as to how such a dreadful disaster could happen in the world today. We're not going to point the finger, or maybe fingers, on this programme. But I want to talk to Elaine Howley, Director of Services at NCBI. She's in studio with me. Hello, Elaine.
Hello, Joe.
Elaine, was Adrian Dunn known to NCBI?
Yes, he was, Joe. Having spoken to our staff who have worked with the Dunn family, Adrian was a very independent gentleman who availed of our services as and when he felt the need. So he wasn't somebody who was always in contact with NCBI, but as he felt the need to contact us in relation to specific issues and specific services he wished to use, he knew where to come.
Does NCBI provide any sort of counselling service for people with sight loss?
We do, yes. We have a number of different counselling services. We have a peer counselling service throughout the country where people who have experienced vision impairment have been trained in counselling skills, and they meet with other people and discuss the issues that are particular to the experience of having a vision impairment. We also have a family therapy service, which I'm involved with myself, with my colleague Cayman Fox. And so we meet with families, with individuals, with groups as appropriate. And so there are different opportunities for people to have counselling type conversations. Throughout the country, there are also a number of support groups where people who experience the same eye condition meet together and discuss issues that are relevant to them, because often people have worries that they don't have an opportunity to talk to other people about, and there is a certain comfort in having a conversation with somebody who's had a similar experience. Things like, for instance, walking into a room and not being able to see who's in the room, or whether or not there are steps, or embarrassing situations that people have been in. And it can be reassuring for people to hear that they're not the only person that has these experiences, and so that it does help for people to have an opportunity to talk to other people.
I'd imagine, maybe I'm wrong on this, and you can correct me if I am, but I imagine that people with sight loss, could they be more prone to depressions and feeling of low self-image than someone who wouldn't have a disability?
Not necessarily, Joe. It very much depends on how somebody comes to sight loss, and how somebody has dealt with other situations in their life, how their life has been to date. You know, there are people who have impaired vision since birth. And for them, for many of those people, it's just part of who they are. Now, there are times that can become an issue for people, very often in transition times when, you know, people are moving from one stage in the life cycle to another, or, for instance, something that comes to mind is when somebody's friends are learning to drive. And so somebody has lived on a par with their friends through their teenage years. They've all gone round in buses and bicycles and walking places. And then suddenly their friends begin to drive cars and have a new independence that the person who has vision impairment throughout their life can't drive a car. So it's at transition times when other people seem to be doing things that you, because of your vision impairment, are finding more difficult. The other way that people come to vision impairment is, you know, they might develop an eye condition during their life. People respond differently to that situation as people respond differently to all situations.
Yeah, if I can just come across you there. I had a story of a blind person, or a person who lost his sight. We'll say, I think he was in his mid-50s, and he dreaded it because he was judging blind people by, judging himself by the blind people or vision impaired people that he'd seen in his own neighbourhood. And, well, they were very dependent on other people, and he didn't want to be like that, and therefore he had the wrong image of blindness. Is that where you're coming from?
It is, in a sense. People have images that they often don't realise until something comes to their doorstep. They have ideas about things, and so what we try to do is explore with people what those ideas are and what their new situation means to them and to their family, because vision impairment affects the individual, and it also has an impact on the family and the people around the person experiencing it. So often in our conversations, we talk to people about that, and we look at what it is that they are what they're finding difficult, what it is they want to achieve in their life, and really, what we're trying to do is to help somebody to continue to have the life that they had before they experienced developing an eye condition. And people sometimes believe that they can't, but actually people, they're still the same person, so they still have the same skills and strengths and coping abilities as they always had. They now just have a new situation, and the thing is for them to get the assistance they need to cope with that situation, to adapt to it, really. So it's an adaptation process, and it does take time, but it happens. People with impaired vision live perfectly ordinary lives.
Elaine, I have to be very careful here that I don't lay the blame totally for this dreadful tragedy on the eye condition. That was the problem deeper than that, or am I right?
I think, Joe, nobody really knows what the problem was. Having spoken to some of our staff who knew the family, there was nothing to indicate that there was anything particularly unusual going on. There was a tendency at the beginning of the week among the media to jump to the conclusion that because, you know, vision impairment was part of this family, because this father was blind, that, you know, there was an automatic link.
But there was blindness in the whole family, right through the family. So it's not something that was sort of a dreadful shock to them, was it? To the family, I mean, the fact that they had a vision impairment.
No. For this family, a number of members have a particular eye condition. It's not unusual. It wasn't a particular issue for Adrian Dunn that we're aware of. But I think it's important to bear in mind that people with vision impairments and people who are blind are living with the same stresses and pressures of ordinary life as everybody else is. And so it would be very easy to forget that. We live in a very stressful and pressured society now, and there are times that it just becomes a little bit too much for people for whatever reason. But in this particular situation, as far as I'm aware, nobody really knows what was going on. But it is a very, very sad, tragic situation.
Elaine, can I talk to you about the system of community resource workers provided by NCBI? How does that work? Is there one in every town or every county? And what's their function, the community resource worker?
There's a community resource worker in every area in Ireland. We have staff who have responsibility for people who have vision impairments in all areas. So it doesn't matter if it's town or country. And when somebody becomes in contact with our community resource worker, who are the first line, the frontline staff, the first thing that happens is they carry out an assessment with somebody. So they talk to somebody about how they're feeling about their vision impairment, what it means for them, what are the things they enjoy doing, what are the things they're finding difficult, what are their concerns for the future. And people have all sorts of worries that maybe they haven't had a chance to chat to their family about. So the assessment includes an assessment of how somebody is emotionally in relation to their new situation, and also physically and practically, how are they using the vision that they have. That, you know, many people acquire a vision impairment and still have some very useful vision, and maybe haven't had a chance to work out how to make the most use of that vision. So what the community resource worker will do is, during this assessment, we'll work out with the person what supports will be helpful to that person. So it could be emotional support, it could be emotional and practical support. For instance, we have a low vision service, which is a rapidly growing aspect of our service, because many of the people that we work with have some vision. And the thing is to help those people to use the vision that they have through magnification, through long-distance telescopes. So there's a low vision service. Then I suppose NCBI's vision is for people who are blind and people who have impaired vision to have the same opportunities, rights and choices as
this was part of the strategic
else.
Plan, is it? Are we
it, is, it is part of the strategic plan. I suppose it's that our aspiration is that people will have the same rights, opportunities and choices to fully participate in society and in family life and in wider community life. And so whatever that takes to enable them to do, NCBI strives to facilitate people. Now, we don't always do it ourselves. We do link people in with their community, you know, what's out there in their community, what other supports there are. There's a lot of networking goes on.
Now this carries me on, if I can interrupt you there. If a community resource worker thought there might be a specific problem apart from the sight loss problem with the service user, for instance, a dysfunctional domestic situation, could that CRW report the problem elsewhere?
Absolutely, they could. Depending on what the situation is, the community resource worker would offer somebody an opportunity to have counselling, to avail of the counselling service, or to talk to them about, you know, maybe if depression is involved, going to their GP and having that checked out, or local HSE services. You know, often we link people in with psychiatric services if that seems to be the way to go. But so certainly, yeah, we link in with what's out there in the community, and we also offer services ourselves. So it's a judgment call between the community resource worker and their regional manager, who'll talk to them about, you know, tricky situations that they may need to try and work out with families, where to go next, how to be most helpful to them.
In today's media, blind people are portrayed as all smiling, singing, dancing, all happy, brave, courageous, and whatever superlative they can come up with. But you and I know that that's rubbish, Elaine, don't we? People with sight loss have the same hopes and desires and emotions as the rest of humanity. I'm sure you'll agree with me on that.
I certainly do agree. There are some exceptional people out there, but by and large, people with vision impairments are pretty well the same as everybody else. Have the same aspirations, the same hopes and dreams, and the same difficulties when those hopes and dreams, you know, can't be achieved, and the same pressures of life, and the same, just the same type of life as everybody else. And there can be assumptions out there that, you know, people who are blind or vision impaired have, you know, exceptional hearing abilities or are amazing to do X, Y, and Z. And well, some are, but I think, you know, the reality is that people who are blind and people who have impaired vision are the same as everybody else.
Elaine Howley, Director of Services at NCBI, thanks for talking to me. Aidan, we have spoken before about this cycle. Now, it's from, I've got my facts right this time, Mizzen to Mallan.
That's right, Joe. That's
in May
right.
The 27th.
May 27th, yeah.
Cycle in aid of?
In aid of Irish Guide Dogs for the Blind. Mm-hmm. And we're hoping to raise, hoping now that we're going to raise in excess of 80,000.
Right, so how many participants are in the particular event?
We're looking at 76 people starting out from Mizzen Head. Not everybody will make it to Mallan Head, but they'll all try. And there's a couple who might have to pull away early for, be it for work or family commitments, or be it fitness deprivations that may mean that they'll only manage to do one or two.
I've got to say that's a good way of saying they'll be knackered.
Exactly, yeah. Well,
a number of them have sight loss, haven't they? A number of the participants.
Yes, indeed. We'll have seven or eight tandems on the road come May 27th. So it'll actually be a record for us. In that previous years, there was only really one or two tandem bikes on the event. So this is the biggest number so far, and it's and then there's one or two people who are, you know, slightly visually impaired but are able to manage a solo bike. So
So and your stoker is
my man on the back. Yeah, he's Martin Gordon,
right.
from Sligo.
What route does it take the trip? Starts in Mizzen,
up to Killarney, and we're staying in the Carnan House Hotel on that Sunday night because they're sponsoring the stage.
Oh yeah,
and then the mayoress of Killarney is going to give us the official start off on Monday morning with an air horn and a countdown, and the whole group will go off then up to Kilkee, and via the Tabard Ferry, so you could say we're cheating a small bit there. Maybe.
You are, actually, yes. Maybe you have to swim. It should be part of a triathlon thing. You should swim across that.
Exactly, yeah. And from there, we're going up. That's Monday. The Tuesday morning, we're leaving Kilkee, going up to Galway, staying in the Great Southern Hotel there in Air Square in Galway on Tuesday night. And we're hoping that we'll have an official starter then on the Wednesday morning, going from Galway to Sligo, and we're hoping to arrange that there with the Lord Mayor of Galway.
Right. From Sligo, the hard part starts, doesn't it?
They, It does, yeah, it does.
It's all uphill then.
Exactly. And we're going up to Letterkenny.
I tell you what I might suggest to you for next week's programme. Could we maybe do next week's programme and talk to various participants in it? You know, get some of them on air and we'll talk about it.
I think that'd be a great idea, yeah?
Yeah, but I just thought on the spur of the moment, we'll talk to people from various parts of the country. And before I go, before I let you go, I think congratulations are in order.
That's true.
I believe, Joe. Yeah, I believe.
Little baby boy here in my arms, yeah?
Yeah, well, I've heard of getting away from things, from sleepless nights. And what he does is, his wife has a baby, right? And then to avoid changing napkins at that hour of the night, he takes off on a 6-day trip. That's brilliant. Seriously, look, congratulations.
We'll talk
to you again maybe next week.
Great stuff, Joe.
Slán.
Talk to you soon. Slán go for.
Just before I go, I'd like to remind you that you can download a podcast of today's programme from the RTE website. My thanks to producer Dave McHugh. Joe Bollard wishing you well. Travel safely. God bless. Bye.
You've been listening to a podcast from RTE Radio. For more details of our podcasts, visit rte.ie.